Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
It's Mike Shope and the Bulldog.
Uh-oh, guess what day it is? Guess what day it is? Huh? Anybody?
Monday, Tuesday, hump day is halfway.
It's Mike Shope.
Mike. What day is it, Mike?
And the Bulldog.
Hey, guess what day it is? Oh, come on. I know you can hear me.
It's Mike Shope and the Bulldog.
Guess what today is?
It's hump day.
Woo-hoo!
On WGR.
Hump day!
Sports Radio 550.
Yes. Welcome. I have an update, such as it is, on Christian Wade, who we talked about a lot 2 days ago.
Okay. Yeah.
I like Sal, of course, and I also like having Paul at these Sean McDermott press conferences. I think Paul has a little bit more of like, this you're just not going to answer that. And I don't know, like Sal may very well detect all the same things as Paul. Like, I just like look at the headline that Paul put up: McDermott not willing to talk about playing time for the Lions game. Like, just, it's really true. I mean, these harmless questions about which he always says, "We'll see. I don't know yet. Yeah. We're going to talk about it all the way up to the game." Basically, just sort of removes himself from having to answer any question about anything that's planned because, like, hey guys. Really, just we're still working that out. We don't know yet. And you never get to him when he knows.
Right, right. His access is gone by the time.
Yeah. I mean, assuming he doesn't know already. So Christian Wade, one of the guys today was Christian Wade. And the question was, simple enough, is there a plan to get Christian Wade some more reps before the fourth quarter? Here's the entire answer. We'll see. I really like what he did in the first two games on limited touches. I love his energy, love his smile. He's going to continue to learn the game and grow. He loves his smile. I might too. He does not, they seem like there's a lot of urgency in figuring out whether Christian Wade can play in the NFL, right? Would you draw that conclusion?
Well, there's not a lot of urgency in him letting you know what he thinks about it. But I have no idea what their level of urgency internally is about it. I would guess maybe not that high. Because
yes, we would.
Yeah, I think we talked about it a lot on Monday. My guess is still that if they do anything with him, it's just going to be the practice squad. But, you know, I also think it would be nice to see the guy play a little bit sooner than the fourth quarter in this next game, just because he's made two huge plays on, like, four touches. And, you know, that's a pretty good batting average.
But apparently, we both predict it means nothing. Because if it meant anything, he would play before the fourth quarter. He would play right at the beginning of the game.
I'm not ruling out him playing before the fourth
quarter. No, I don't want to say. I'm not ruling it out. Okay. But you've convinced me to rule out any possibility of him making the roster.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I hope I'm right about that. But that's really how I feel. Like, it would still stun me if he got an opportunity and did so well with it that the Bills just went, hey, you know what? Yeah, let's just put him on there and I don't know, we'll figure out what to do with these guys that are experienced who we agreed to pay. It would stun me if that happened.
What would you do?
What would I do? I would play him in the second quarter of this game on Friday, and if he makes another huge play against what you might assume, or you might be able to tell, obviously, whether it's better competition, then I might start respecting it a little bit more. But right now, I hate to say fluky, because that inherently, like, discredits the guy, and, yeah. and I don't really want to do that, but, you know, I think it's just kind of whoever was playing running back for the Bills on those plays, I think would have made a big play, especially the play against Indianapolis.
Really?
The play against Indianapolis was just, if you, you know, can see what you're doing, you notice the whole right side is open, you cut it back and you run. I think Marcus Murphy makes that play. Now, you know, the catch and run on Friday against Carolina was a little bit more than that because he made, you know, like three guys around him and came through that. So I don't know that just anybody would make that play, but it, I don't know. Neither of them were like otherworldly something, you know?
No.
So, you know, for now it's just, I think kind of, okay, well, that's a nice story.
I don't think there's any any value in playing anybody else instead at running back in the first quarter on Friday night. I don't think there's any reason to play any particular player there. So do what you want. What is, I don't know. You know what? Can we just not? Because like, does there really need to be one more discussion of the preseason and the strategy behind playing guys and not playing? Does there really need to be one more look at that?
I don't mind if it results in reaching this conclusion. So I don't want to like, you know, like set this up so that it spits out a certain result. But man, I think that this preseason, more than any other, is looking like the league is going to have a really good leg to stand on to just cut the thing down if they want to. And I don't know if that means that we'll get the 18-game proposal, like, formally, and that becomes a thing. I guess I would expect that to become a thing in CBA negotiations.
Well, there's a new one.
But these – oh, there is.
There's a new proposal.
Okay.
Two more playoff teams and one fewer preseason game.
Right. Okay. The games are just getting less and less useful, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, last week while the Bills were in Carolina, this was a theme – that like Sal and I talked about, and I think we got into it with Chris Brown and Eric Wood on the roundtable before the Carolina game. These joint practices functionally get you better results, like a better look, a better evaluation of your team against another team than a preseason game, because you can really set up what it is you want. Like I got three corners battling for two spots. I need to see them in some man coverage. And so, okay, like you're just going to set that up with Ron Rivera or whoever on Carolina and just do that. You can do that 10 times if you want with each guy or more. Where in a game, you got no guarantee that the ball's going to come to the guy that you're trying to evaluate.
You know what? You're not allowed to do that in games. You probably should, because nobody cares whether you win,
right,
except maybe John Harbaugh. And you can't do that, though, or you certainly don't want anybody to know you've done it, because you can bet on them.
Right, right.
Remember when Denver was here, was this during Lossman? And I think maybe this is Mike Mularkey.
It was Mularkey that
admitted
that
he and Mike Shanahan figured out something about...
Yeah, they talked about what personnel they were going to use and how long guys were going to play. And just they wanted to make sure they had the matchups right, basically. Like, how long are you going to use your ones? All right, that's what I'll do, too. There's the ones-on-ones, twos-on-twos, like that, to try to keep it fair, I guess. I just saw today Frank Reich has now decided to not play. He was going to play starters, with the exception of his quarterback, who's dealing with an injury.
And this might be a big reason why he's doing this.
But was going to play guys in the third preseason game. That's the one that's most like a real game. It's a dress rehearsal. The starters play into the third quarter. We wanted to come out after halftime and get the feel of coming out after having orange slices and instructions to start the third quarter. Yeah, all the stuff you've heard, the cliches for years and years and years about the third preseason game. Frank Reich is like, we're not even going to play the guys at all. And a part of the reason is he talked to Nagy, who said, I'm not playing my starters. The Bear coach, that's who they're playing the Bears. Like, well, he's not playing his starters. I guess I won't play my starters either. Like, okay, what are we really doing? How many games do we need to decide who the second string and third string linebackers are going to be?
You don't need any.
You shouldn't.
You don't need any games.
All you need to do is do what the Bills did last week, which is go to Carolina and, you know, get on the field with another team competing and or choreograph these, you know, these head-to-head matchups that you need to evaluate and go from there.
You don't need those either, but you're going to have those. Like you can have that. I mean, Ohio State doesn't go to Georgia in practice to see who their backups are going to be. They just decide. You know, they just decide. Right? How come the pros can't do that? They easily could. They're supposed to know. And it doesn't even really matter that much necessarily if they're wrong, because you're still talking about backup. You're still talking about thin lines between players. I say necessarily because, you know, that there can be differences and importance to that. But really, the games aren't for that. The only result that matters in the preseason is if you lose somebody important.
Right.
And if, like, it's a little bit tied up because the Bills running backs, like, you have the older guys, and I'm not sure. Sometimes Trent Green gets hurt and you have Kurt Warner and win the Super Bowl. Like, it sometimes works out for you if you have this kind of thing happen. But, you know, overall, if you lose a starter in a preseason game, that's bad. And it's really your own fault if you do, because there's no really real need for them to play.
It feels to me like this summer, and this has been building for a while. Maybe it's a little bit reminiscent of how the Pro Bowl deteriorated over the years. To, you know, be like, boy, it doesn't really even look like they're trying. And I think if you go back and watch the games, I don't know why you would ever do this, but if you did have the mind to do it, where you first thought it didn't look like they were trying, I'll bet it looks a lot more like they're trying than it does now. It's just gotten worse. Like, once everyone just sort of, it got out in the open, and everyone like, yeah, nobody's really trying, then I think guys really started not trying. And I think the preseason, I think we're on the cusp of that with these exhibition games, because teams are being more and more cautious with their guys. They're letting you know by their actions, not their words, because they will still give lip service to how important it is to have these games and hitting other colored jerseys and yada, yada, yada. But in reality, what they're telling you is, I'm not playing my starters at all. You know why? Because I don't need to. I don't need to. I don't need these games. These games are not important. These games only matter to the league because they generate millions of dollars in ticket sales. They're included in season ticket packages. Everybody gets two of them, and they're okay, there we are. It's a giant grift.
I think part of that too is that, cause this reminds me of tanking, actually. Part of that too is that fans are more sophisticated. Like, fans know the real deal with the preseason better than they used to. You used to get an argument toward anything we're talking about now. Now there's never an argument.
For years I'd sit in here and say the Bills' number one offense should play these whole games. They don't know what the hell they're doing.
I used to think that.
I don't know who my quarterback is. Shouldn't he get all the reps he can get, whether it's against third stringers or not? Make him play. I got to figure out if Ryan Fitzpatrick could run this offense.
So why is that now not the right choice? Because this isn't a good offense yet.
I think that it's become the right choice because of the fear of injury. I think that is.
But injuries are not at least that much more prevalent. Right?
No.
The difference is you are more sophisticated.
Yes.
The difference is you know more. Now, I don't think I could quantify for you. I certainly right now couldn't. Just like, okay, can we prove that? Do we know that the injury risk, like the percentage of guys who are injured in these games, whatever thing, versus, it's really hard to do this. I mean, you can't really prove at all how playing helps you. It's just sort of a logical assumption.
Right. You'll be better at it. Repetition. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But now I think we all kind of think that that isn't worth it. That might not even be true or true to any meaningful extent. So now sit.
Yeah.
And so tanking, but just to say, like, tanking was, you know, teams might have thought we're really not better off going 6-10 than we are 3-13, or we really aren't better off with 80 points than we are 60 points. So what do you think? Fans got on board. I mean, a lot of fans got on board with that, and there's data that drives this. And so when you have that, and then you have sort of at least an acceptance from the fans, then you're okay.
Right. What can I get away with, basically? Like, what can I sell? Can I sell this? Are people going to buy it? Not everyone will, but if enough of your fans get on board, then like I think you feel like you're in the clear. Okay, we're okay here. We're good here. Okay, let's do that. And I think that's what the preseason is. Like, I think more and more fans get set to watch these games and mostly just don't want anything bad to happen to the guys they want to watch play in October. That's it. I mean, you know, I'm enjoying watching, I said it yesterday, like I'm enjoying watching these preseason games, and I don't really know what's changed for me, but I'm liking watching them more than I have in the past, but it's not at all driving me to like, I want to see, get John Brown on the field. Like, you know, like I'm not worried about that at all. I'm just sort of watching football and hanging out, and I'm fine. But yeah, I think the organizations, the coaches, the GMs, whoever, the owners, have realized the value in protecting those guys, and the fans are generally okay with it. I say generally because I'm sure some people that are paying for tickets would like to see John Brown play, if LeSean McCoy, whomever. But I think mostly your educated football fan goes, yeah, don't play those guys now. You don't need to do that. So we've gone from the third game is the dress rehearsal, they'll play into the third quarter, to, you know, in the case of the Colts and the Bears, the starters aren't even going to play at all.
And you've had Todd Gurley sit the whole preseason and Le'Veon Bell sitting the whole preseason. Right. Like the very biggest stars in the league maybe are more likely now to not play at all through the whole four weeks. So that judgment has been made by teams too.
Yeah.
They don't need any of it.
So I don't know what in the end, whether we'll get the extra playoff teams like you're talking about, and you know, games added to the schedule and a reduction in preseason games. But I would guess, much like they felt they had to deal with the Pro Bowl in some way, that and the commissioners even admitted this going back a couple of years, that there's problems with the exhibition season.
His first year.
Okay.
The first thing I ever heard about Roger Goodell was that he thinks the preseason could or should be shorter.
Wow. All right, good
memory.
And
the first thing I ever said about Roger Goodell on the show was that this is promising.
Yeah.
Because he might not be. I mean, what an awful take this was in retrospect. He might not be beholden to the owners to the same extent. Like, I mean, just what a horrible thought that was.
Right.
He conned me by even just alluding to the preseason as being too long.
Yeah.
I fell for it.
Yeah.
For one day.
So, I mean, it sort of started with the fourth game. Used to be they barely played. The fourth game looked kind of like the first game. And then the fourth game gradually became nobody that matters plays at all, to such an extent that the Bills actually, for a few years in a row, went out and signed a quarterback to specifically play in that game so nothing would happen to the guys they care about.
So it meant less to them than a practice would.
Yeah. I mean, it was ridiculous. And that's been going on, at least in Buffalo, for a few years now. And, you know, here we are where the third game guys aren't even going to play.
If they did that this year, who would be, like, your favorite idea? It has to have some basis in credibility. It can't be like Fran Tarkenton.
No, right.
Right? He's too old for this idea.
I don't know that they really need to worry about it this year because they've got a guy that I think.
No, I don't think they do either. But
right.
EJ would be fun.
Yeah,
to have him sign and like guys sign 1 day contracts and then retire. Let's sign him and have him play against the Vikings.
The Bills had really 1 week contracts with Jordan Palmer and Chris Sims and a couple other guys.
Matt Leinart.
Thank you. Right. Yeah. Those might be the
most
three.
Notably.
Yeah. So, I mean, Tyree Jackson will play that entire game, and then I think it probably get cut, and that'll be the end of him. I don't even think he's it's not something we're really deeply analyzing, but I've watched every throw he's made this preseason, and he has looked really bad. It's really too bad. Like, he was an intriguing, exciting idea, but he's not even, to me, making the practice squad at this point. Like, he just doesn't look ready to play in the NFL at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
No. Anyway. So he's got that fourth game locked down, I would think.
Yeah. It means less than a practice does to teams.
Yeah.
Okay. There are games tomorrow night. The Bills game is Friday night in Detroit. Then it's Minnesota here next week. And I feel funny even promoting these things now because of the last 15 minutes of conversation, which is basically, why would you even do that? But we still would like you to tune into those games there. So today, we are going to talk to Therese Paylor later. He's with Yahoo now. He was with the Chiefs when we first met Therese, and that was when the Bills traded for Kansas City's first-round pick, and they used the deal to draft Patrick Mahomes, of course. Now he's covering the league for Yahoo, and we'll talk Bills and Chiefs and other teams.
Yeah, he's been in town here. I think he was even still here today. I know he was here earlier in the week. He's been making the rounds of NFL camps. Do you remember anything about our very first conversation with him?
Yes.
I remember this one thing specifically was we asked him about Mahomes right away. And he just said, I don't know right away, but like within the conversation, like what's the early returns on him? Like, this guy's going to be a rock star.
He loved him.
Like he's sure. He's not going to play this year, but man, he's going to be a rock star. So I don't know if he's here watching Josh Allen the same way, but I'm sort of curious to hear what he thinks about watching Josh Allen practice after he gave us that opinion. That
he's been complimentary to Allen with us.
Kind of, yeah.
Most guys are when they, cover the league and they come on. Yeah, I remember that because I, for a while, like sort of fought against it. Like, why does Patrick Mahomes have to be so good? Because he's good in practice?
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did we know that? But here's a guy who would tell you, I know. I knew it. I could see it. And other people with the team or whatever could see it. Well, they would have been right. Also, and we'll do this right after this first break, Steve Seftel has a book called Shattered Ice. He played professional hockey for many years, ultimately into the NHL with Washington. And his book is partly about mental illness and his career, and it's kind of good and interesting. And we'll get to know Steve a little bit. He's been listening to us for a long time, apparently, and reached out. I know he's been doing a lot of book promotion in Canada, and he's got the official opening is tomorrow night. So he reached out, you guys want to talk about this? And we said yes. So that'll be in just a few minutes here, a little hockey talk with Steve about his life and career. Eventually, you'll be able to reach us at 803-0550. Mostly football again today, of course. Mike Schopen, the Bulldog here, back with Steve Seftel, his book Shattered Ice coming out, and we'll talk to him after the break on WGR.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, hate to interrupt the music, but we are going to continue our show. And as it happens, we're pleased to have Steve Seftel on the West Her Hotline. Steve is a former professional hockey player who has written a book about hockey and more called Shattered Ice. Steve, Mike, and Chris here. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. It's my pleasure to be a guest on your show. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thank you. So your book is about your career and also mental illness and the struggles within your career and life. Elaborate, if you would, Steve. Tell us your story.
Well, it's important to know, Mike, that I wasn't diagnosed with a mental illness until 2 years ago when I had a complete, what I would call, mental breakdown, and was in a condition where I couldn't get out of bed and I didn't want to get out of bed, and I became physically ill from the mental illness. But as far as my hockey career goes, the first time I was aware of this, I was about age 16. It was the first time I had my first panic attack. And that one happened when I was in Czechoslovakia playing my midget Kitchener green shirts on a trip we had over there, and I was stuck in an elevator. But that was the first time I was aware of it. And I played 3 years in the Ontario Hockey League for the then Kingston Canadiens. I suffered somewhat through those years, but I didn't really understand it because it was not, mental health wasn't something we talked about. And those feelings followed me into my pro career, drafted by the Washington Capitals second round, 40th overall in 1986. And then I did play for the Capitals in the 90-91 season, but I was in the organization for 7 years, and I left about 1993.
Do you feel like you left a lot on the table with your career because of the mental condition you were in during, you know, all that time? I mean, you obviously achieved enough to be the 40th pick in the draft. It's not like you were under the radar or anything, but do you feel like it really held you back? Do you think your career would have been different if you had received some kind of assistance or treatment in those years, Steve?
I do, and it's unfortunate that back then we didn't talk about it. I mean, the mentality then was be a warrior. You pay the price. You do all the things you have to do to be a hockey player. And it's basically whatever it takes. And talking about how you felt mentally was not part of that playbook. And it was things started to spiral for me out of control was really in early of 1992 after the Capitals training camp. And I was coming back from my second ACL tear, and that was really a devastating blow. And we never... Something else we don't take into consideration is the trauma players suffer from injuries. But it was, again, not part of the mentality or the makeup of the time, and it's just you dealt with those things on your own internally. And as a result, I think it does have a cumulative effect and definitely affected me leaving quicker than maybe I should have.
Did you ever – how close did you ever get to talking to someone, confiding in someone, be it a teammate, a trainer, a coach, a family member, whatever, like during this whole time? I would say from the time it first cropped up, you said, while you were playing juniors in Czechoslovakia, all the way through to your pro career. Did you ever get right to the edge of actually talking to someone about, hey, something isn't right with me, I want to talk about it?
I did not, and I'll be honest with you, it was 2 years ago. It was the first time I ever discussed it openly with anyone other than my wife. But back in those days, I didn't discuss it at all and never even thought about it. But 2 years ago, I was asked to watch Michael Landsberg, and he has some really good videos about mental illness. And that is truthfully the first time I ever heard anyone openly discuss it. And it actually opened the gate for me to starting to go down the road where I would talk about it with family and friends.
With Steve Seftel, author of the book Shattered Ice, former professional hockey player. So I think I would expect, Steve, most players from your playing days to say the same thing about how players were not open about like their feelings, to put it that way. What I don't know is, well, okay, I'll go further. I think I know I would also expect to hear my wife and my close friends say, no, it's totally okay. You should. You know, I think people around me would be like that, supportive and open and encouraging like that. What I don't know is what it would be like in sports right now or in hockey right now. Bulldog might, because his son is playing, you know, close to playing at the junior level with the Greyhounds and made that team and now is going to be playing it in high school. And, where do you think, if you know, like, as you've talked to people, Steve, you must know a lot of people in the game still. Doug McLean wrote the foreword for this book, even. How far have we come?
I think, you know, I compare it to turning an ocean liner around. So it takes a long time to turn that ship around, and I think it's just begun. So we're slowly changing the direction of the ship. There's still a lot of work to do. I think, I know from the Ontario Hockey League, there is a preparation course or an mental health awareness course that the players are taking now at training camp. But there's still a lot of work to do, without question. And we can tie this into concussions as well, dealing with the head.
Yeah.
Whether it's concussions, mental illness, it's the brain and the head has been ignored for far too long, and it's starting to change, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of there's a lot of former players that have been, I think, pretty vocal. Daniel Carcillo comes to mind. I don't know if you're familiar with the work he's done. A lot of it's just on Twitter, raising awareness about head injuries. And I'm thinking about even national corporate initiatives like Bell Let's Talk. I think is something that happens once a year within in the hockey community. But at least on Twitter, it's like everybody I follow that's affiliated with hockey in any way is in on Let's Talk About Mental Health. So I think there is I feel like it's earnest and well-meaning, like how far it's getting in these early stages, like you're referring to this ocean liner. I mean, I can't say, but I think an effort's being made.
I would agree with that, and I think Bell Let's Talk is also a great initiative. And I hope at one point we get to this a day where it's not just a one-day event in the course of the calendar year, that it's something the players are comfortable talking about whenever they need the support or the help from their coaches and the teams, and that it's just not something we kind of promote once a year. But, I mean, it's a starting point, which is a good thing. And
right.
I know from my own situation, my year, something that hit me hard was Joe Murphy was the first overall pick of my draft year by the Detroit Red Wings.
Yeah.
I know he's suffering. Well, I shouldn't say I know he's going through some of his own personal struggles, and you know, it just shows you that there's a lot of high functioning people who still suffer from mental illness.
Yeah. If people aren't familiar with Murphy's story, he's been homeless. A lot of former teammates and players tried to reach out and help him, and I think did for a while. But then he walked away from that, and he's had numerous concussions in his career. And I think he might be like the headliner story for this sort of conversation right now, because first overall pick, very good career, and his personal life, once he stopped playing hockey, just unraveled, and he stopped playing hockey in part because of the number of head injuries he had.
Absolutely, and I think, you look at Joe, he had a number of concussions, but something else we have to look at, as you said, that's a severe case, but there's also people out there struggling who sometimes they're just in a rough patch, and they're going through some depression and anxiety, and they think there's no alternative and no way out, and we have to, we got to look at everybody and just give the opportunity to people to seek out help and listen to them when they need someone to talk to.
Yeah. How when you were coming up in juniors and it started to look like maybe this was something you could really take to the max, like, you're going to get drafted, you could make the league, did that create a pressure internally that was hard to manage? Like, is that a part of this story? Because Mike referenced my son. I think about that with him all the time, because the farther you go, the higher the stakes get, right? And it's set up, it's almost like all I got to do now is land the plane, right? Like, you've got this next spot set up for you, and then this next spot, and it's all going well, just don't screw it up. And I think that creates a lot of pressure.
I agree, you're right. So I got drafted in June of 1986, went to the Capitals training camp in that September, played quite well. I got in two exhibition games. I have a chapter in my book called Bork's Corner. My first exhibition game was against the Boston Bruins at the Capitol Center, and Ray Bork was in the lineup, so that was an amazing thrill for me. But right after that camp, as you were saying, the stakes getting higher, I signed a contract with the Capitals after returning to Kingston, and that's when I felt things did start to ramp up, and I did feel more internal pressure to succeed game in and game out, that I was always auditioning, and as you said, you just got to land the plane, and you are on this track, and the pressure definitely built, and sometimes it's a self-inflicted pressure cooker, but it is, there's no outlets at the time, and you go down that road, and it can be.
We still have you, Steve? He might have dropped off.
Yeah, we lost him there, I think. Yeah.
I was about to tell him that I think I saw him play.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, with Miners? Baltimore.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned to Rob Ray a number of times that Rob scored an overtime goal for Rochester when I was going to their games in my college years, and he remembers it. And Barry Trotz was the Baltimore coach, and Steve would have been on that team. A lot of his book toward the end is... Give him back? Okay. Steve, I was just saying, I think I saw you play for Baltimore.
In Rochester?
Yes, yes. Because it came back to me when you were writing about Trotz toward the end and having some difficulty with him. And he was the coach of that Baltimore team. I remembered that. And we've talked to Rob Ray about an overtime goal he scored against Baltimore in the playoffs. Is that a memory you have?
Yes, it is. That was a playoff game. I think that year Doug McClain was our coach. That was a dagger in that series, that overtime goal by Rob Ray.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
Oh, Rob Ray with a dagger. I can't wait to talk to him about that.
He doesn't bring it up every time he sees you. But how about Trotz? Like, what I got from your book was that, you know, you might have looked up to him and then you struggled in terms of communication with him eventually.
Well, when Barry Trotz, when I first was drafted, Barry Trotz was a scout with the Capitals organization. And then he was promoted to assistant coach in Baltimore under Rob Laird. And then Mr. Poile fired Rob Laird and Barry assumed the head coaching job. That was his first head coaching opportunity with the Baltimore Skipjacks. So relationship changed because I knew him as a scout and then an assistant coach. You know, often assistant coaches are the one you bounce things off as a player. And now he was the boss. And to approach him as the boss was a little more challenging. And, mm-hmm. But I was going through my own personal struggles at the time. And like we talked about, I didn't know how to ask for help. And I probably didn't go about it the best way. A chapter in my book, I talk mm-hmm. about how I didn't go to a golf event.
Skipped
a
golf tournament.
Of all things not to go to, I skipped a golf event.
Right.
And he was very upset with me, and that at least that started some dialogue. I think the reason I skipped that event is I just wanted to talk to somebody in the organization about the way my career was headed. And we did clear the air that way, but I certainly at the time... We talked about my playing, but we did not talk about what I was feeling inside mentally. So I still buried that, and it came back to bite me in the end.
So how are things now? Like, you've written the book. How is it being received? And like, since you've talked to, you mentioned you for a long time didn't talk to anyone but your wife, but I assume you've talked to your family about it now, and like, it's all out there. How are you feeling with all of that, you know, being so public now?
It was very challenging at first. I went to see Doug McClain in March. He was one of the first people I told outside of immediate family and close friends. And it was difficult to get the words out. I was sputtering and stumbling over trying to tell him I had a mental illness. And he was surprised. But he certainly said, he said to me, I wish I could have helped you. But I said, you can't, because I would have never told you at that time. Back in those days, but and I asked him to write the foreword, and since then it has just been a continuous flow of reconnecting with the players I've pushed away for the last two decades, including guys like, you know, another former Rochester American, Scott Metcalf, who I mm-hmm. played junior with in Kingston, and Scott Pearson, who's an ex-Saber mm-hmm. in Toronto Maple Leaf. He played with me in Kingston as well. He was the best man at my wedding, and Doug McClain, Rob Laird, my former coach, Jack Button drafted me back in the day. He's no longer with us, but his sons, Craig Button and yep. Todd Button, reached out, and they've read the book as well. Recently, Kenny Albert reached out to me. He was the play-by-play mm-hmm. man with the Skipjacks when I was in there for my last couple of years. So it's been incredible to have all these the hockey family coming back to me, as I really thought they had disowned me, but they didn't. It was just me convinced my brain telling me lies.
Well, Steve, it's been a pleasure getting to know you here. You're a good writer, and it's a good story. And I think it's also something that we really, if it isn't self-evident, it would be, of course, relatable and interesting to players who played sports and then left sports. Because that in and of itself is tumultuous and challenging for a lot of guys, you know, I've heard and read. So I think people might relate to that, too, if that's their story. Good luck. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. And I'm a huge Bills fan, which I was hoping, Mike, you would say, do you have any questions for us? That's your famous line.
Yes. Well, please ask if you do. I should have said that.
Yes, because I always look forward to that when you ask your guests. So my question was going to be, do you think the Bills are a playoff team?
Well, it's possible. I mean, they're in the middle, and all the teams in the middle have a chance. I'm not assuming they are. I'm not expecting them to be, but, you know, they certainly are not. They're not Miami or something where you'd think that's almost definitely not happening.
Yeah, the Patriots make it particularly challenging. Steve, you know how often we talk about that if you listen to the show on any kind yes. of basis as a Bills fan. Like, you got to win the division or you got to battle the vast middle class of the entire conference for two spots. And, I mean, that is a tough way to live.
Yes, I know. I've listened to you guys talk about Mr. Brady and Mr. Belichick for many years. yes, it is very challenging being in that division. Yeah.
They're the only two people who've been working together longer than we have. Brady and Belichick. Yeah. Little known fact. All right.
Thank you for writing this book, really. The content, I think, is important, and it's very well done. So congratulations to you for doing it.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on. It's been a real thrill for me.
Thank you, Steve. All right. Good luck. Keep in touch.
All right.
Steve, bye-bye. Steve Seftel, S-E-F-T-E-L, and the book is called Shattered Ice. You follow him, you'll see from his Twitter a lot of just announcements and updates on his book and appearances he's making. We'll talk to Therese Paylor about the Bills in the NFL season coming up in 15 minutes. Mike Schoep and the Bulldog here on WGR.
On the lines of me talking about evaluating and the college frustration of me not getting offers and saying that winning comes first if you're a quarterback. And, you know, I can absolutely understand the relation to that, and there's no question about it, which is why I felt like reaching out to Daniel. But that's the type of thing that frustrates me because it was taken out of context, and then on top of that, now we're talking about something that's not about the Browns.
Boo-hoo. It's our fault that Baker Mayfield said what he said about Daniel Jones is not his responsibility. It's ours for not knowing the proper context. Okay, sorry, Bakes. You call him that, too, in conversations?
Oh, Bakes? Only in text.
This guy would drive me nuts.
Only through text.
He'd better be good. Maybe he's off to a good start. Yeah. Nice player. He better keep it up, man. These guys who... I'm very defensive about the media in many situations, as I will tell you and have told you. And, like, these guys who just say a thing and they just can't stand there and say, yeah, that's right. I mean, what's so hard about that? Well, I mean, I don't want to say that. I mean, it's not easy to take ownership sometimes. It's not easy to do that, but, man, it was misconstrued. Whatever. The Browns are one of the most interesting teams in the league. Yeah. Maybe number one. I'm calling Dallas number one right now, though.
Yeah.
There's so much stuff there. I mean, what is going to happen there? Cooper has got an injury, too.
Yeah.
Prescott wants his money. He's there. They're just toying with Elliott. They're toying with him. Jerry Jones is toying with him. Yesterday, the coach was talking about how good Tony Pollard is. Maybe he's good, but still, like, they're just really toying with Elliott. And... fine. I mean, okay, but do they really? Are they really going to go ahead without him? That team was in the second round last year, and I kind of hope they do. I think it's cool.
I can't imagine. I you've been saying for a while here, and I even really like wanted to just echo it, but they completely seem like the sort of team, and Jones seems like the sort of owner that will just. Okay, all right. We want to give you 11. You want 15. 13 and a half. Can we come on? All right, come on. And, like, Elliott would feel some compulsion to just do that because Jones is, like, he's the owner. He's a popular – he's a media figure. I mean, he's a superstar. He's a superstar owner. Like, that's different than dealing with, I don't know, like some guy that doesn't have a profile. You know, I just would expect it to get done at some number in between where they're both standing and that he won't miss any games. Yeah, but, I thought last year Bell wouldn't miss any games, so what do I know?
Right, and there's the analytics thing within it. Like, is the running back important? Does it matter if you have Ezekiel Elliott there or not? Recent examples might tell you that it doesn't. It's kind of how I feel. Jerry Jones is not Warren Sharp. I mean, since when is Jerry Jones Warren Sharp? Where he's like, you know, you don't need to win a rushing title to win a Super Bowl, like he said a couple of weeks ago. Is that the position of the Dallas Cowboys? That, like, it doesn't matter whether he's here?
Right.
Because that's how they're acting. Therese Paylor would be a great guy to talk about this with. And we'll have him on talking some Bills, too, of course, next here on WGR.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.